Now move to question time, and I'll call Senator Birmingham.
Thank you, President. My question is to the Minister representing the Prime Minister, Senator Wong. I refer the Minister to statements by French President Emmanuel Macron that, quote, nuclear energy is a source that is necessary to succeed for carbon neutrality in 2050. I also refer to statements by the United States Special Envoy for Climate, John Kerry, that, quote, we can't get to net zero 2050 unless we have a mixture of energy approaches, and one of those elements, which is essential in all the modelling I've seen, is nuclear, end quote. Does the Albanese government agree with President Macron, Secretary Kerry and many other world leaders that more nuclear energy generation is an essential requirement to achieving net zero?
Thank you, Senator Birmingham. Minister Wong.
Well, I have to say, President, I am surprised to get a question about what President Macron said from the coalition. But obviously they are very keen to press the nuclear energy point. There are countries around the world which many decades ago made a decision to go down the nuclear path. Some of the countries that you have referenced are amongst those. Australia made a choice not to do that, and Australia has made a choice to look to the comparative advantage that we have when it comes to the cheapest forms of energy, which is firmed renewables. We have more sunlight that hits our landmass than any other country. We know that we have so many untapped resources when it comes to renewables. And I appreciate that the opposition are on this very, very committed to the nuclear path. I understand Mr. O'Brien has said that he'd be happy to have one in his electorate. That's a matter for him. But we will focus on the form of energy which is the cheapest form of new energy, which is renewable energy, rather than what is frankly an ideological agenda from those opposite when it comes to nuclear. Now, there are countries in the world, France and others, which have many years ago chosen to go down the nuclear energy path. That is not the approach Australia has been taken. We have some of the best wind and solar resources in the world, and that's why we joined so many countries to support a key push on renewables and energy efficiency at the Conference of the Parties.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Birmingham, first supplementary.
Thanks, President. First supplementary question, Senator Wong. Given Australia is home to an estimated 35% of the world's known uranium reserves, is it in Australia's national interest to encourage greater global production of nuclear energy?
Thank you, Senator Birmingham. Minister Wong.
Well, it's in Australia's national interest and every country's national interest to press for and to help deliver net zero by mid-century. There are different paths to that approach. Australia has taken the view that I have outlined, which is that we have untapped resources of renewable energy and that we know from what we have been told by regulators and by the markets that the cheapest form of new installed energy is renewable. I would also make the point that the opposition have been on this for many years. When I was climate minister, I think I got the same questions. People might recall, I think John Howard tried to get Ziggy Switkowski to tell us that it was financially viable. The reality is we'd rather put that public investment, if required, into those areas where we have a comparative advantage.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Birmingham, second supplementary.
Thanks, President. The declaration to triple nuclear energy, signed at COP28 by countries including the United States, Canada, France, Finland, Netherlands, Japan, Republic of Korea, Sweden and the United Kingdom, set the aspiration for more nuclear energy but also recognised, quote, the different domestic circumstances of each participant. Why didn't the Albanese government sign the declaration?
Thank you, Senator Birmingham. Minister Wong.
I think this is what I have in my brief as the pledge, and if I'm wrong, I will come in and give you some further information, Senator Birmingham, but I'm advised that of the 22 nations that signed the pledge, 18 already have a nuclear energy industry, so only four, obviously. Moldova, Morocco, Poland and Mongolia signed the pledge as countries without nuclear power. There are a number of countries with nuclear energy industries that did not sign the pledge, and Australia joined 117 other countries to sign a pledge to triple global renewable energy capacity, which reflects the priorities that we have and the priorities of the government.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Billick.
Thank you. My question is to the Minister representing the Minister for Health, Senator Gallagher. There are now 47 Medicare urgent care clinics open across Australia. These clinics are designed to enable Australians to access urgent care in a primary care setting rather than attending a hospital emergency department. Could the Minister provide the Senate with an update on recent clinic openings, how many people are using the centres across Australia, and how these clinics are helping Australians to access urgent health care when they need it?
Thank you, Senator Billick. Minister Gallagher.
Thank you, President, and I thank Senator Billick for the question and acknowledge the opportunity I had to visit the Family Planning Tasmania with Senator Billick to open the Endometriosis and Pelvic Pain Clinic earlier this year. It was a great opportunity again to extend primary health care and try and take some pressure off hospital emergency departments, but there are now 47 Medicare urgent care clinics open and operating, including the Alice Springs Medicare Urgent Care Clinic, which opens today. 47 clinics running and with 58 to be opened by the end of the year. The Medicare, as senators know, the Medicare urgent care clinics are 7 day a week, extended hours, open to walk-in patients who need urgent but non-life-threatening care, either for themselves or, of course, for their children. And we're getting some excellent examples of how these clinics are meeting the needs of that patient group. We had a young patient and his mum who went to the Ipswich clinic with a suspected broken wrist from playing basketball for the young child. He was triaged in just 5 minutes. He was seen shortly after by a doctor. He was x-rayed. He was treated with a splint and he was connected for a physio appointment the following week. This was all done within 2 hours. Another patient took her daughter to the Penrith Medicare Urgent Care Clinic when her daughter sustained a possible ankle fracture from playing soccer. Her daughter was seen, x-rayed and discharged with a cam boot in less than 1 hour. The patient's mum said, "Why would anyone go to the emergency department with this sort of injury when the Medicare Urgent Care Clinic can deal with it so quickly?" So far across Australia, there have been more than 75,000 presentations to Medicare urgent care clinics, nearly a third of patients under 15 years of age, a third of visits on the weekend, and on weekdays, more than one in five visits have taken place after 6 p.m.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Billick, first supplementary.
Thank you, and it was a pleasure to spend time with you in Hobart too, Minister. One of the aims of opening Medicare urgent care clinics is to help ease the pressure on busy emergency departments across the country. Is the Minister aware of whether the Medicare urgent care clinics are having any impact on the number of presentations to hospital emergency departments?
Thank you, Senator Billick. Minister.
Thank you, President. I thank Senator Billick for the supplementary. These clinics are not just providing high quality urgent care when and where people need it. They're doing so free of charge. And we are seeing some very pleasing data coming in, and I do acknowledge that it is early days, but the idea behind the Medicare urgent care clinics was to take particularly category 4 and 5, as they are known in hospital emergency departments, non-urgent or semi-urgent presentations, and to relieve some of the pressure there. It's early days, but at Logan Hospital in Queensland, category 4 and 5 presentations have gone down by 10%. Since the Logan Medicare Urgent Care Clinic was opened, and at Ipswich Hospital, there's been a 20% reduction in that type of presentation, which obviously has significant benefits for the hospital. So this, while it is early days, we are pleased with the results that we are seeing, both in the numbers of people using the clinics, but also the impact that they are having on hospital ED departments.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Billick, second supplementary.
Thank you. Minister, the Medicare urgent care clinics are one way the government is acting to strengthen Medicare. How do the urgent care clinics complement other steps the government is taking to strengthen Medicare, and why is the government so determined to strengthen Medicare after a decade of cuts and neglect?
Minister.
Thank you very much, President. I thank Senator Billick for the question. Well, the Medicare urgent care clinics are just one part of our program to strengthen Medicare. In the budget this year, we've had the bulk billing incentive, and tripling that bulk billing incentive really making a significant difference. Some doctors' groups have called it game-changing in terms of being able to use and continue to use bulk billing for patients, but also through our delivering cheaper medicines. Again, I went through last week some of the savings that we've seen for people in the order of $20 million per month from having cheaper medicines and cheaper scripts. But those things together with our Medicare urgent care clinics, the work we're doing around workforce, the work we're doing to negotiate a new pharmacy agreement, it's all about ensuring that we are strengthening Medicare and making healthcare accessible and affordable to Australians.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Cash.
Thank you. And my question is to the Minister representing the Prime Minister, Senator Wong. Minister, how many detainees, including paedophiles, rapists, murderers and a contract killer, have now been released into the Australian community? And how many of those has the government tried or are trying to resettle in another country?
Minister Wong.
Thank you. I refer to the statement issued by the ABF on Sunday, the 3rd of December. And I believe, I understand in that the Australian Border Force confirmed that two detainees, one in New South Wales and another in South Australia, have recently been charged and one individual remains in police custody. I'm advised that obviously both those matters are subject to court proceedings, so I'm not in a position to provide further detail at this stage. In relation to this cohort, as the Shadow Minister would be aware, the government, in addition to standing up a joint police operation as between AFP and state and territory police forces, introduced the Migration Amendment Bridging Visa Conditions Bill, which passed the parliament, which allowed ministers to add conditions on bridging visas granted to non-citizens released from immigration.
Minister Wong, please resume your seat. Senator Cash.
Look, it is a point of order in relation to relevance. The question was in relation to how many have now been released into the community and whether or not you are pursuing resettlement in relation to any of them.
Thank you, Senator Cash. The minister did refer to an AFP statement, which of course I don't have before me and don't know the contents of, but I will remind the minister of the question, but without knowing the full details of those statements, I really can't rule. Minister Wong.
In relation to the number so far released, I am advised that as a consequence of the High Court's decision, the 148 individuals have now been released from immigration detention. If I could go back, though, because I would have thought that the Senator would be interested in how we try and keep Australians safe in circumstances where the High Court has ordered the release, which decision every and any government is required to observe. The government has passed the Bridging Visa Conditions Bill. The government also brought in strengthening of that legislation, the Bridging Visa Conditions and Other Measures Bill 2023, which criminalises further bridging visa conditions. I note that this is the bill that the government, at the opposition, for some reason, voted against.
The time for answering has expired. Senator Cash, first supplementary.
Thank you, and Minister. It has been reported in the media that at least three of those have been released with no conditions imposed on them. Can you explain why there have been no conditions on their release?
Thank you, Senator Cash. Minister Wong.
I'm not going to, with respect to Senator Cash, I'm not going to take as read what she is asserting. If she has questions about the exercise of a minister's of that law, I'll certainly see if we can provide any further information in the absence of any further detail now, but I would make the point if Senator Cash and those opposite are interested in increasing the penalties on persons released, then perhaps Senator Cash could explain to the chamber why she, her party, voted with Adam Bandt and their party against legislation which was designed to increase the severity of penalties, increase the severity of penalties under...
Senator Cash.
Well, Senator Cash, I'll take the interjection. And she now says because we had to wait for the High Court. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Because as I recall, you were in here being very loud about why we
didn't have to wait for the High Court.
So which is it, Senator Cash?
You've got to... Senator Cash, second supplementary.
Thank you. And Minister, will the government provide details to the Australian people on why it was necessary to release each of the 140 detainees into the community, including paedophiles, rapists, murderers and a contract killer?
Thank you, Senator Cash. Minister Wong.
First, we are providing briefings to the opposition, which she, Senator Cash, is aware of. Secondly, this goes to the fundamental point. These people, individuals have not been released because the government made a determination that they had to be released. These people are being released as a consequence of the High Court decision, which struck down laws that you had in place. Not the first set of laws of yours that they have struck down. We don't believe that you actually make people...
Senator Cash.
Well, Senator Cash, I know you want to interject a lot on this, but I would make this point. You are supposed to be the Shadow Attorney General. Yes, the Shadow Attorney General understands the separation of powers. The Shadow Attorney General should understand that a government under the Westminster system does not act like an autocratic dictatorship and actually does
you,
what
Minister
the court
Wong.
Says. I know
thank
that
you,
Mr.
Minister
Morrison
Wong.
Wanted
the
a very different approach in robo debt.
Order. Order. Senator Waters.
Thanks, President. Before I start my question, can I just, on behalf of the Greens, convey my deep condolences to all of you for your loss? I'm so sorry to hear of Ms. Peter Murphy's passing. My question is to the Minister representing the Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Minister Wong. The world's largest annual climate talks are currently underway in the United Arab Emirates, and this year's President of the Climate COP, Sultan Al Jaber, has claimed that there is no science indicating that a phase out of fossil fuels is needed to restrict global heating to 1.5 degrees. This is directly at odds with the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres's position, who said to COP delegates, the science is clear, the 1.5 degree limit is only possible if we ultimately stop burning all fossil fuels, not reduce, not abate, phase out with a clear time frame. Does the Australian government support the UN Secretary General and the world's climate scientists in condemning this harmful fossil fuel industry spin?
Thank you, Senator Waters. Minister Wong.
Well, we support our targets, which are include in excess of 82% renewables in our grid by 2030 and net zero by 2050. I've said in this chamber to you, Senator, and to others in your party, that we recognise the scale of transformation of Australia's energy grid and energy sources that is required on that. Australia is a very fossil fuel intensive economy, and we've benefited from that economically over many decades, but that is no longer the world in which we live, and we have to live in a world where we can thrive in a net zero economy, and that means a massive transformation. And unlike the Greens, we have a difference of views about how you achieve that. I think the approach in the Greens seems to be you just stop. Well, we say you actually have to transform, you have to actually shift, you actually have to generate new capacity in renewables. And the measures that Mr. Bowen announced the week before last, or last week, I'm sorry, I'm losing the weeks towards the end of the year in terms of capacity investment, are designed to do that. So a lot is said internationally, a lot is said domestically. If I may say, I think too much of the climate debate has been a lot of rhetoric and not enough about policy. We're interested in policy that actually transforms the Australian economy so we can be the renewable energy superpower that we have sought to be for so many years but has never been delivered.
Senator Waters, first supplementary.
Thanks, President. I note the 5 coal and gas approvals issued by this government. This year's COP President, Sultan Al Jaber, is also the chief executive of the United Arab Emirates' state oil company, ADNOC. ADNOC has the biggest oil expansion plans of any fossil fuel company in the world. Does the government agree that an oil executive holding the COP presidency constitutes a serious conflict of interest and, as Al Gore has said, an abuse of public trust?
Thank you, Senator Waters. Minister.
Well, in relation to the quip at the start, I'd say QED. That's precisely the sort of response that there always is from the Greens. That you're not actually interested in the economic policies which are required to ensure that we shift to renewables. You want a political protest over certain issues. Those are matters. I'm not going to respond to the assertions made in much of that. I'm not familiar with some of the assertions or that you're making. What we are responsible for is our approach. We have ambitious targets. They are going to be tough to meet. They are going to require sensible economic policy. They are going to require us to create the incentive for the market to invest, which has not occurred for a decade, and we are focused on ensuring that transformation takes place.
Senator Waters, second supplementary.
Thanks, President. More than 100 countries, including the US, which is the world's biggest oil and gas producer, already support a phase-out of fossil fuels. Will the Australian government join more than 100 countries at COP28 to ensure that a fossil fuel phase-out is included in the final COP28 agreement, or will you continue to side with coal, oil and gas companies?
Thank you, Senator Waters. Minister Wong.
I'm always interested in the binaries that the Greens decide to put up to. No, they're binaries that you choose to put up in order to make political points that don't actually do anything on the climate. I think our position of 82% renewables by 2030 is demonstration of the effort we are making. Now you may think that there's some switch that the world can throw. Well, I'm sure, why don't you yell a bit more? I'm sure that'll fix the climate, Senator Wish Wilson. I mean, the reality is your party does not have a single policy that I can see that will actually transform the economy. You want political protest and you want slogans, but not actually any policies around transforming the energy grid or the economy, which is a tough job, and it is one we are focused on.
Senator Sheldon. Senator Sheldon.
Thank you. Thank you. My question is to the Minister for Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, Minister Watt. Minister, now that we are in December, it's officially the festive season and families around the country are beginning to plan for their Christmas celebrations. We know that Australian families look forward to sitting down with their families to get great Australian produce on Christmas Day. With cost of living pressures front of mind in all Australian households, what is the Albanese government doing to assist Australian families with the price of groceries in the lead up to Christmas?
Thank you, Senator Sheldon. Minister Watt.
Thank you, President. Well, Senator Sheldon, I'm sure you'd agree that Christmas is the most wonderful time of year. For one thing, the Senate isn't sitting, and that's a good thing for all of us. But more than that, it's a time to get together with friends and family, spend time relaxing in the sun, and to eat, drink and be merry, but not too much, of course. But it also can be a tough time for Australians struggling with cost of living pressures. Presents for the kids, fuel to get to the other side of town to visit your family, fresh seafood as well as drinks, the cost of Christmas can really add up. So anything that can be done to give families a hand during this time is obviously beneficial. And those with the most to give should be the first to help. And that's why today I've called on the big supermarket chains to freeze the price of Christmas hams. The traditional ham, I'm surprised that the opposition don't think that's a good idea. Sneering at the idea of freezing the price of Christmas hams.
Order.
How concerned about cost of living you are. Well, the opposition might be surprised to hear this, but the traditional ham is a staple of any Christmas lunch in Australia. I would have thought you would have known that. It's time for supermarkets to do their part and say one thing we won't put up is the price of a Christmas ham. Guaranteeing a price freeze on ham would allow families to manage their budgets in the weeks leading up to the holiday. And I really would have thought that this is something that the opposition could get behind, but apparently not. It's always politics for them, not caring about the average Australian citizen who's trying to save some money. Farmers also need certainty that they'll get a fair price from supermarkets. These supermarkets have been recording increased revenue and profits while households and farmers are feeling the pinch. For the average Aussie, it doesn't make sense that the price on the bottom of their docket at the supermarket is going up, while these companies are recording massive profits. And that's why for some time now I've been calling on the supermarkets to drop their meat prices and be more competitive for Australians. The government is doing our bit to help with cost of living pressures, and now it's time for the business community to do their part. Since coming to office, the Albanese government has increased the maximum competition penalties from $10 million to $50 million, and we'll keep working
Senator
on this.
Senator Sheldon, first supplementary.
While Australian families are turning their minds to Christmas Day, they're still thinking about broader cost of living pressures. What other supports is the government providing to Australian households to assist them in the lead up to Christmas?
Minister Watt.
Thank you, Senator Sheldon. And I thank you for your efforts, along with all senators in the Labor team, for delivering real cost of living relief for Australians, something that the opposition have failed to do. We know that Australians are doing it tough, and that's why helping with cost of living pressures is this government's number one priority. And while the parliament is taking a break for Christmas, I can tell you that people still get sick, kids still need looking after, and households still use energy during the festive season. And that's exactly why the Albanese government has delivered $23 billion in targeted relief while not adding to inflation pressure. For instance, we've delivered electricity bill relief, opposed by the opposition. We've made medicines cheaper, opposed by the opposition. We've made it easier and cheaper to see a doctor, opposed by the opposition. We've delivered cheaper childcare and expanded parental leave, opposed by the coalition. We've built more social and affordable homes and increased rent assistance, opposed by the coalition, and we've delivered fee-free TAFE as well as making sure wages are rising.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Sheldon, second supplementary.
Given that dealing with cost of living pressures are the number one priority of the Albanese government, what obstacles does the government face delivering cost of living relief to Australians, and how does the government intend to deal with these?
Before I call the minister, I am going to call for order, particularly on my left. Minister Watt.
And President, it continues to amaze me that every time we talk about delivering cost of living relief, we get laughter from the other side. I mean, it might be a laughing issue on the North Shore of Sydney, somewhere that Senator Sharman knew very well until recently. But it's a very real issue that Australians are dealing with, and that's why we are doing everything we can to help. But unfortunately, the biggest obstacle to all the cost of living relief that we're providing to Australians is the Liberal Party and its leader. As I say, over the last few weeks, I've called on the supermarket chains to cut their meat prices, and I'm pleased to see that starting to happen. And I'll give credit where it's due. We have seen the Greens political party, Senator Lambie, and even the Nationals joining us in putting pressure on the big supermarkets, but we've heard nothing from the Liberal Party. Total silence, because they are the party of no solutions. In the past 4 months in question time, the Leader of the Opposition has asked just three questions on cost of living. That's how much he cares about it. He's asked no questions on interest rates, energy or Medicare, because he doesn't care about cost of living relief and opposes everything we try to do.
Thank you, Minister Watt. Order. 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 Senator Birmingham. Senator Roberts. Order across the chamber. I have Senator Roberts on his feet. Senator McKim, order. Senator Hughes, I've called you a number of times. Order. Order. The crossbench do not get the same opportunities as the bigger parties in this place. Senator Roberts has been on his feet for quite a few seconds waiting to ask his questions, and yet your rude and disrespectful comments across the chamber continued. Senator Roberts.
Thank you, President. My question is to the Minister for Finance, Senator Gallagher. ABC reports in July revealed that hackers were able to exploit loopholes in the government's MyGov system and, as of February 2023, lodged more than $500 million in fraudulent tax claims. Given the Minister's claims that a digital identity would be secure, can the Minister please provide an updated figure on how many billions of dollars in fraudulent claims hackers have lodged to date in exploiting MyGov system vulnerabilities?
Thank you, Senator Roberts. Minister Gallagher.
Thank you, President. And the first thing to say about that is MyGov is different to MyGov ID. They are completely different things. So I don't have updated information. Well, MyGov is the site you go to, as many people in this place will have, to engage with government in an online way. MyGov ID is a digital ID that you control and own and use for verifying your identity, and for MyGov ID for lodging, if you're a business, for engaging with the tax office in particular. There are 10.5 million Australians who have a MyGov ID and use it for that purpose, but it is very different to the question that Senator Roberts raises around the MyGov system, which I don't have an update on. It falls under the Minister for Government Services portfolio. I'm happy to see if there's something that that minister would be able to provide you around an update on that. MyGov obviously is a system that we invest heavily in to make sure that it is usable and safe for people when they are engaging with government, but that doesn't change the comments I made last week about the digital ID system being safe and trustworthy and voluntary. If you're an individual, you will not have to have one of these digital ID, but if you do want one, the option is there, and it's a way of reducing the amount of information that government collects in order to verify your identity. So the two things, MyGov ID and MyGov, and I accept that they are similarly named, are very different, very different things indeed.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Roberts, first supplementary.
Thank you. Minister, in June, Russian hackers compromised top-secret Australian Defence Force data. In July, NDIS participants were exposed in a data breach and the Department of Home Affairs leaked personal small business information. In August, the Department of Veteran Affairs leaked medical data. In September, Australian Federal Police data was hacked. Minister, why is it falsely claimed that the government's digital ID is secure when the government can't keep data secure?
Thank you, Senator Roberts. Minister Gallagher.
Thank you. Well, I don't accept the proposition that's being put by Senator Roberts. Yes, government systems are under constant attack and threat, as most businesses are in this country, from cybercrime, from hackers, and from scams, and you know, criminals that are engaged in such activity. And so the government invests heavily in protecting our systems and making sure that they are safe, but in a sense, you're making the argument for a digital ID, because a digital ID is about reducing the amount of information that a government holds on you, about you, for services. Because of the way the system works, you retain the information, but you are able to have your ID verified through a process of exchange that allows those systems to be unlocked. It is absolutely fundamental to the digital ID system is reducing the amount of information, having the safeguards in place to protect
info. Senator Roberts, second supplementary.
Thank you. Minister, will the government support a One Nation amendment to the Digital Identity Bill explicitly stating that no Australian will ever be denied access to services because they do not have a digital ID? Or is the claim that the digital ID won't be compulsory just misinformation?
Thank you, Senator Roberts. Minister Gallagher.
I'm happy to engage with you genuinely on digital ID, Senator Roberts. I accept your interest in it, and I am very willing to work with anyone in this chamber about making sure that the legislation that passes this place is the best that it can be. In relation to your specific question, as part of the bill, we do require that services be maintained and offered for people that do not want to have a digital ID. So that protection is there, but I am very happy to engage with you more broadly on the bill, and including in other areas that you might have concerns about. That clause specifically relates to individuals. As you know, MyGov ID is required for business-related services, and part of that is about minimising fraud and identity theft, verifying individuals as part of their engagement with the tax office.
Senator Hume.
Thank you, President. Yeah. My question is to the Minister representing the Prime Minister, Senator Wong. Should Australians prepare to live with interest rates being higher for longer, as forecast by ANZ CEO Shayne Elliott?
Thank you, Senator Hume. Minister Wong.
Well, what Australians
will have, or do have, is a government that is working very hard to fight inflation. We've seen some moderation in the most recent inflation figures. Obviously, much more is required. But we are committed to fighting inflation because we do understand the effect that inflation has on families, on cost of living, and how people are struggling as a consequence of higher inflation. We're focused on fighting inflation. We know that the opposition are fighting anything but inflation. What we know is that a number of the measures that ensured that
Senator Hume.
Madam President, on relevance, I mentioned interest rates, not inflation, and the minister has yet to actually use the phrase interest rates.
As you know, Senator Hume, I can't put words into the minister's mouth. Senator Hume, you're not in a debate with me. You're not in a debate with me. Please resume your seat. As I said, I'm not in a position to put words into the minister's mouth. I'm happy to remind her of the question, but I do believe the minister is also being relevant. Minister Wong.
I'm interested in a proposition that inflation is not relevant to interest rates.
That seems to be the point of that. That seems to be the point of that. That seems to be the point of that point of order, is that somehow a discussion of inflation is not relevant to interest rates. As the shadow minister knows, interest rates are set independently by the Reserve Bank. What governments can do is ensure that we engage in the fight against inflation. Unfortunately, when we've needed, and the Australian community have needed allies in that, instead they've had an opposition determined to oppose the measures that the government is seeking to put in place to fight inflation. I mean, I would remind the shadow minister that without our energy plan, electricity prices would have risen 18.8%. 18.8%. instead of 8.4. So you're happy for electricity prices to go up nearly 19%. That's the position of the opposition. Energy price relief that you voted against.
The time for answering has expired. Senator Hume, first supplementary.
Thank you, President. Is the ANZ CEO correct when he states that the rate of current government spending will keep interest rates higher for longer?
Thank you, Senator Hume. Minister Watt.
As I recall, this government returned a surplus in 22-23, and I know that is difficult for the coalition to accept because they trumpeted the back in black, got the mugs out, were quite triumphant, but then of course didn't actually deliver one. And I know that's very hard for them to accept, President. But the reality is this is a government that returned a surplus of $22.1 billion in 22-23. It was a dramatic improvement from the forecast, nearly $78 billion deficit that we inherited. In fact, that is a $100 billion turnaround, the biggest nominal budget improvement in Australian history. We've returned 95% of revenue upgrades to the bottom line in 22-23. That is more than double the average of the previous government. So I have to say, I don't think we'll take a lecture from those opposite who returned deficit after deficit.
Thank you, Minister.
And
time for
did not return revenue
upgrades. Senator Hume, second supplementary.
Thank you, President. With the Reserve Bank Governor describing inflation as now being a homegrown problem, and the ANZ CEO identifying current government spending as a driver of higher inflation and higher interest rates, does the Prime Minister and the Albanese government accept any responsibility for the pain and mortgage stress being felt by a record number of Australians?
Thank you, Senator Hume. Minister Wong.
We understand how tough so many Australians are doing it, and we do not shirk our responsibility to do all we can to fight inflation. And unlike those opposite, we're not going to be distracted by the political arguments. Unlike those opposite, we're not going to be voting in this chamber against energy price relief. Unlike those opposite, we're not going to be focused on political fights. We are going to be focused on fighting inflation, which is the key, which is the key driver behind the cost of living challenges that so many Australians have. And unlike those opposite, we are also not going to be running a low-wage economy. We're not going to be holding wages deliberately low, because we understand that also matters when it comes to cost of living. Well, I'll take the intervention from the Shadow Minister, who said, well, that pushes up inflation too. We have the Matthias Cormann line here, that in fact there's a deliberate design feature of the Australian economy to hold wages low. I don't think that should have been scripted for you.
The time for answering has expired. Order, Senator Wish-Wilson.
My question is to Senator Wong, representing the Environment Minister. Last year, your government announced its commitment to a zero extinctions target for Australian native flora and fauna. During this announcement, Minister Plibersek proclaimed, "I will not shy away from difficult problems or accept environmental decline and extinction as inevitable." Minister, the ancient endangered Morgellon skate has been with us since the dinosaurs, is found only in Macquarie Harbour on the west coast of Tasmania, but has seen a 47% decline in its tiny population between 2014 and 2021 since the expansion of industrial salmon farming in the harbour. Scientists researching the skate tell us it is possibly one extreme weather event away from extinction. Given El Nino forecasts for marine heatwaves in the coming months in Tasmania, what is your government doing to immediately safeguard the skate from an extinction event this summer?
Thank you, Senator Wish-Wilson. Minister Wong.
Thank you. I think I got a question last week from Senator Dunningham, which was probably the other side of this discussion, and I appreciate, as with so many issues in Tasmania, they're very strongly held views on either side of a very clear line. And I appreciate that your focus is on one aspect of these matters in relation to Macquarie Harbour. I got a question last week in relation to the Tasmanian salmon industry, and I would refer you to my answer to Senator Dunningham in relation to the industry. Look, we understand I'm advised that the Department of Climate Change and Energy, Environment and Water will soon begin consultation about salmon farming in Macquarie Harbour. The consultation is as a result of applications made under the National Environment Laws by three groups who argue that salmon farming is having an unacceptable impact on the Morgellon skate, as you said, an endangered fish. I'd make the point that the environmental laws which require these applications to be considered were passed by the Howard government in early 2000. In addition, Ms Plibersek has announced a $2.1 million commitment to establish a captive breeding program to help the Morgellon skate. There will be an opportunity in the consultation to consider the work of the joint Tasmanian and federal government Morgellon skate recovery team, the decision of the Tasmanian government's EPA, conservation advice for the Morgellon skate, community views and any other relevant matters.
Senator Wish-Wilson, first supplementary.
Thank you, President. Minister, the government's own conservation advice states that increasing water oxygenation through immediately destocking industrial salmon farming is the most critical action required to save the endangered skate from extinction. Why is Minister Plibersek consulting, ignoring the science and shying away from this difficult problem by not immediately pausing salmon farming in Macquarie Harbour?
Thank you, Senator Wish-Wilson. Minister Wong.
Thank you, President. Thank you to the Senator for his question. There are quite a number of assertions in that, which obviously I don't accept, and I'd refer you back to the fact that the status of the current applications and the commitment that Minister Plibersek has made to consultation. After the consultation period ends, the department will take some time to carefully consider the information received. The minister has indicated that salmon farming in Macquarie Harbour does not have to pause while this occurs. I infer that that is a decision open to her. I also infer from what you have said that's not something with which you agree, but that is obviously the decision. That is the decision that the minister has made.
Senator Wish-Wilson, second supplementary.
Minister, I'm going to ask you a question that perhaps you and I can both look back on the answers when we leave this place. Can I ask you one of the great moral and political questions of our time? How many industry jobs are worth the avoidable extinction of a critically endangered species? Specifically, how many salmon industry jobs on the west coast of Tasmania are worth the extinction of the ancient Morgellon skate?
Minister Wong.
I think we've made clear we do support the aquaculture industry, including the Tasmanian salmon industry, but we've also said that the industry needs to continue to demonstrate that it can operate in a sustainable and responsible manner. And I think, some on one side of the debate will say that any environmental regulation is anti-job, on the other side of the debate, you have some on your side of the debate who seem to assert.
Order, Senator Wish Wilson. You've asked your question. The minister is answering. Minister Wong, please continue.
I know that we're back to binaries again. I know that it is politically easy and useful for campaigning to.
Senator Wish Wilson, I've called you to order. Senator Wish Wilson. Senator Wish Wilson. Minister, please continue.
Well, again, I understand that there are some who have a very clear view about yay or nay. I think that it is possible, with goodwill and good scientific evidence, to try and ensure that industries operate sustainably.
Thank you, Minister. That is a good thing for environment and for jobs. Has expired. Senator Stirl.
Thank you, President. My question is to the Minister for Trade and Tourism, Senator Farrell. Since being elected, the Albanese Labor government has been commended for its careful and considered management of international trade relations. This praise has come from all quarters, including from the agriculture, resources, manufacturing and the service sectors, as well as civil society and the labour movement. Australian exporters in particular had benefit. They felt they were let down badly by the former coalition government. Minister, please outline how the Albanese Labor government has been on the front foot to grow the Australian economy through its support of exports.
Thank you, Senator Stirl. Minister Farrell.
Thank you, President, and thank Senator Stirl for his question and his interest in trade, which so benefits his home state of Western Australia. The coalition's mismanagement of trading relationships and denial of climate change hurt our country's trade and investment relationships. But in just 18 months since the Albanese government came to office, I'm pleased to advise that Australia's trade agenda is being progressed in a stable and positive way. Trade impediments affecting Australian exports to China, for instance, worth $20 billion have been removed or are on the pathway to removal. By any measure, this is a huge achievement which has been positively acknowledged by miners and farmers right across Australia. Australian exporters are benefiting from the Albanese government's hard work to finalise trade deals with the United Kingdom and India. Exports to the United Kingdom have increased significantly in the first 4 months of the agreement entering into force, including beef, which increased by around 320%, honey by more than 170% and sheep meat by 35%. Great news for farmers, including in your home state of Western Australia, Senator Stirl.
Good news.
And right across the country. And Australian exporters are taking advantage of the trade deal with India. Agricultural exports have grown by 86% in the first 7 months of 2023, and exports of manufactured goods such as pharmaceuticals, wood and paper products, cosmetics and medical devices have increased markedly. Trade is vitally important to the Australian economic prosperity. More exports mean more higher paying jobs for Australian workers.
Senator Searle, first supplementary.
Thank you, President. Now, under the steady stewardship of the Albanese Labor government, many of the trade impediments imposed by China when the coalition government went in power has now been removed, which is particularly great news for the Australian mining and agriculture sectors. I know you can and I know you will, Minister, but please identify Australian exports to China that are directly benefiting from a mature hand on the trade policy tillet.
Minister Farrell.
Thank you. Thank you, President, and thank you, Senator Steele, for those wonderful words. The Albanese Labor government is working hard to stabilise our relationship with China without compromising on what is important to Australians. Our efforts have led to positive trade developments, including the lifting of trade impediments affecting Australian coal, cotton, copper ores, logs, horticultural products, oat and hay and barley. Industry appreciates this hard work with Viterra, a great company based in South Australia, acknowledging a 66,000-tonne barley shipment last month from Port Lincoln. I'll say that again, 66,000-tonne barley shipment from Port Lincoln, and it would not have happened without this government's efforts. We've secured a pathway towards an early resolution of the wine dispute with China, and recent developments mean Tasmanian cherries and apples
are headed back to China. Thank you, Minister Farrell. The time for answering has expired. Senator Searle, second supplementary.
Thank you, President. The Albanese Labor government was responsible for bringing the trade agreements with the United Kingdom and India into force. Could the minister please outline how the swift implementation of these two trade agreements are benefiting Australians?
Thank you, Senator Steele. Minister Farrell.
Thank you, President. And yes, I can, Senator Steele. Our trade agreement with the United Kingdom and India are helping Australian exporters. A range of Australian exports to the United Kingdom are benefiting from lower UK trade barriers, including beef, chocolate, confectionery, honey, sheep meat, aluminium, motor vehicles and medical devices. Since the entry into force of the trade deal with India, around 85% of Australians' goods exported by value now enter India duty-free. Australians are expected to save about $200 million annually in import duties paid on UK goods. Both the United Kingdom and India trade agreements are supporting Australian jobs and helping with cost of living pressures for Australian families. This government's trade agenda is delivering for all Australians.
Thank you, Senator Canavan.
Thank you, Madam President. My question is to the Minister representing the Minister for Infrastructure, Transport, Regional Development and Local Government, Senator Watt. Last week we had the extraordinary spectacle of the Queensland Deputy Premier travelling all the way down here with a delegation of mayors to demand that the government restore funding for Brisbane's Olympics infrastructure budgeted by the former coalition government. On Saturday, the former chairman of the Australian Olympic Committee, John Coates, panned the government's changes, saying that we certainly had all the commitments at the time when we went forward with this bid, and they've been confirmed previously, and I'm struggling to see how they can now renege on them. Did the government consult with the Australian Olympics Committee about the potential impacts on games preparedness before putting projects like the Sunshine Coast Rail at risk?
Thank you, Senator Canavan. Minister Watt.
Thank you, President. And Senator Canavan, thank you for the question, because it gives me an opportunity to point out that the coalition government, while making promises about funding of infrastructure for the 2032 Olympic Games, of course, did not commit or provision in the budget one single cent. Now, the last time I looked at building construction costs, you don't really get a stadium for 0 cents. You don't get a road for 0 cents. You don't get a rail line for 0 cents or for $0. And that's exactly the amount that was committed by the former coalition government and, of course, has been improved upon by the Albanese Labor government. And that's why the budget that we handed down this year, the 23-24 budget, actually delivers real funding, not just promises, on the Australian government's funding commitment towards the 2032 Games. And over the forward estimates, $504 million has actually been firmly committed in the budget papers, not just promises, firmly committed in the budget papers towards the Brisbane Arena project, and $512 million towards the 16 new and upgraded venues across southeast Queensland, which is a total of $1.076 billion. In total,
Watt,
the Albanese
Minister
government.
Watt, please resume your seat, Senator Canavan.
Thank you, Madam President. Look, my question was a very simple and direct one. Just did the government consult with the AOC? And the minister's gone nowhere near that today.
I'm not sure I'd call it a simple one. There was a fair bit of preamble in there, but I'm happy to remind the minister. I'll draw the minister to that part of your question, Senator Canavan. Minister.
The government, of course, consults with the AOC, the Queensland government and various other partners in the delivery of the Olympics infrastructure on a regular basis. And I know from previous reports that both the Queensland Government and the AOC has been very pleased that they now have a federal government in place that is actually prepared to deliver real funding for the Olympics infrastructure rather than the hollow promises that we had from the former coalition government. So as I say, in total, the Albanese government is delivering $2.5 billion for the Brisbane Arena development and up to $935 million for the minor venues program. This is real funding, not just promises.
Thank you, Minister. Just a moment, Senator Canavan. Senator McKenzie, I am going to ask you to withdraw the comments you made as the minister was speaking in regards to mistruths.
If it assists the chamber, I withdraw.
Thank you. Senator Canavan, first supplementary.
Thank you, Madam President. Minister, given the Queensland Government's cost blowouts to the M1 Pacific Highway Varsity Lakes to Tugan upgrade and the Albanese Government's 50-50 limitation on funding, what other Brisbane Olympics supporting transport projects have been put at risk by Labor's infrastructure review?
Thank you, Senator Canavan. Minister Watt.
Well, the only thing that put any Queensland infrastructure projects at risk was the fact that the former coalition government did not budget for those projects, did not have business plans for those projects, did not have a single dollar in the budget and didn't have the skills and the labour needed to deliver those projects. And that is why we have had to do the hard work that the coalition government was never prepared to do, to actually work out in this inflationary environment which projects can be delivered and which ones need to be paused for a period of time. Now, in the process, we have followed through on funding for almost all of the projects that were previously committed to by the former government, but there are some that need a business case to be actually prepared before they can be delivered. And Senator Canavan, I haven't seen you out there clapping the federal government for delivering the funding that was needed for the cost increase to the Rockhampton Ring Road. I have seen you doing a lot of campaigning, scaring people that the funding wasn't there, but now that it actually is there, you haven't said a thing. So get out there and
Minister,
get on board.
Senator Canavan, second supplementary.
Take me to ask a question about the Rocky Ring Road, but I'll stick to my script. Will the government commit to complete Bruce Highway projects, including the Gateway Motorway to Dolly's Rockies Road upgrade and the Linkfield Road overpass project supporting accessibility for the 2032 Olympics?
Thank you, Senator Canavan. Minister Watt.
Yeah, President. Thank you, Senator Az. I was just thinking about this. I've never seen Senator Canavan so interested in the southeast corner of Queensland. I mean, we know he used to be a Marxist before he went to the Productivity Commission and now he's in the National Party. We know he used to be in Logan before he
Minister
went
Watt,
to Rockhampton and tried to take care about that.
Minister Watt, Senator Ruston, please. I'll come to you, Senator Rennick. Senator Ruston, I am going to ask you to withdraw those comments.
If it assists the chamber, I withdraw.
Thank you. Senator Rennick, were you still on a standing?
What a relevance. Senator Watt has done nothing but make personal smears against Senator Canavan. He's asking a serious question about infrastructure.
Senator Rennick, that is not a point of order. Order. Order across the chamber. Order. Senator McKenzie. Senator McKenzie. Senator McKenzie and Senator Wong. Order. Order. Minister, I am going to draw you to Senator Canavan's question.
Thank you, President. I'm happy to provide a bit further information about the funding that is being provided, but now that Senator Canavan has returned from his bogus central Queensland roots back to his southeast Queensland roots, I look forward to him revisiting his Marxist era when he was at school or university. I've forgotten which one it was. Many of the projects needed to support the Games
Minister
are already
Watt,
being funded.
Your seat, Senator Scar.
Point of order, President. Senator Watt should specifically withdraw the word bogus, which impugns the motives
you,
of Senator Canavan.
Senator, order, order, order. When senators rise on a point of order, I would prefer that you didn't use the offensive word. I will ask him to withdraw. Minister, please withdraw.
I withdraw. Many of the projects needed to support the Games are already being funded, planned and delivered in the current infrastructure investment pipeline in order to support the growth of southeast Queensland. And I'm pleased that Senator Canavan now recognises that southeast Queensland deserves support as well. For example, the M1
order,
Pacific Motorway
Senator
upgrade
McGrath.
Program that we're delivering $2.1 billion, the Coomera Connector Stage 1, where delivering $1.06 billion, Brisbane Metro $300 million, Gold Coast Light Rail Stage 3, and of course there's money for more planning
thank
for
you,
the Sunshine
Minister,
Coast
the time
Rail
for
as well.
Answering has expired. Senator Green.
My question is to the Minister representing the Minister for Infrastructure, Transport, Regional Development and Local Government, Senator Watt. Across regional Australia, local communities have concerns about access to secure and affordable housing. One of the biggest things that I'm hearing from regional communities and businesses is that if we don't fix the housing shortages caused by 10 years of delay, we won't be able to house the skilled workers that we need. Doctors, nurses, teachers and tradies all want to live in our regions, and we need houses for them. What is the Albanese government doing to help Australians buy homes and relieve cost of living pressures?
Thank you, Senator Green. Minister Watt.
Thank you, President. And it's great that we've got a senator over this side of the chamber that cares about regional housing. The Albanese government understands that safe and affordable housing is central to the security and dignity of all Australians. And a decade of no action from the Noalition left us with significant challenges across the country. The result is that housing affordability, once only a problem for our major cities, is now a problem right across the country. Regional businesses and councils have jobs to fill, but attracting the workers they need is difficult because there's a shortage of housing for the workers to live in, and the Albanese government, unlike the Coalition, is actually doing something about it. We've delivered the largest investment in new affordable and social homes in decades, the $10 billion Housing Australia Future Fund, a commitment for 30,000 new social and affordable rental homes in the first 5 years, opposed by Mr Dutton and the Coalition. That's how much you care about housing.
Order.
That's how much you care Order. About housing in regional Australia. You voted against the Housing Australia Future Fund and 30,000 new social and affordable rental homes in just 5 years. These are the homes that Australia needs in the regions that they need them. But the HAF is just part of our government's ambitious housing reform agenda. The Regional First Home Buyer Guarantee, since its launch, has helped more than 13,000 regional Australians get into homes. And importantly, our Help to Buy scheme will cut the cost of buying a home by up to 40% for low and middle income earners. It'll bring home ownership back into reach for 40,000 Australian households. The Help to Buy scheme is an important part of our housing agenda.
Senator Green, first supplementary.
Thank you, President. I've heard from constituents who are frustrated that access to affordable housing was neglected by the Liberals and Nationals for a decade. Why is it important that Australians have... Sorry, President, I'm the one asking
Order.
The question and I can hear Order. Senator Hughes over me. So.
Order. Please continue.
Why is it important that Australians...
Senator Hughes,
why is it important that Australians have safe and affordable housing, and what action is the government taking to get around obstacles to this?
Thank you, Senator Green. Minister Watt.
Great question, Senator Green. And as you know, safe and affordable housing is vital not only to protect our way of life, but for the continued economic prosperity of our regional areas. But unfortunately, it appears that there is a new alliance in Australian politics, a new coalition that continues to stand in the way of access to housing for Australians. And all of a sudden, Senator McKim is looking very guilty, very guilty. The coalition of the unwilling between the National Party, the Liberal Party and the Greens political party stands like a dam wall to block every effort the Albanese government makes to build new homes.
Order.
We saw it first
Order.
With the Housing Australia Future Fund, where the Greens teamed up with the LNP for months to delay $10 billion of federal housing investment until they were shamed into supporting it. And last week we saw it again. When the government tried to move ahead
Senator
with our
McGrath.
Help to Buy scheme, what did the coalition of the unwilling between the Liberals, the Nationals and the Greens do? They pushed it off to April. When it comes to housing, Labor offers Help to Buy.
Thank you,
the
Minister.
Coalition of the unwilling
Thank
just
you, Minister.
Says goodbye.
The time for answering has expired. Senator Green, second supplementary. Just a moment, Senator Green. Order. Senator Colbeck and Senator McKenzie. When I say order, it applies to you. Senator Green, second supplementary.
Thank you, President. Minister, cost of living and affordable housing is front of mind for all Australians. What barriers do Australians face to accessing housing and much needed cost of living relief, and how does the government intend to remove them?
Thank you, Senator Green. Minister Watt.
Thank you, President. Well, Senator Green, the barriers are all around us. The barriers to housing in Australia are all around us. They start over that side and they end just on the other side of Senator Grogan over there. The biggest barrier standing in the way of our progress in developing new housing is this new coalition of the unwilling between the Liberals, the Nationals and the Greens. Let's look at their record. They partnered up last week to vote against stronger
Order.
Immigration laws. They partnered up months ago to vote against the Housing Australia Future Fund. They partnered up to vote against the Nature Repair Bill. And last week, they partnered up to delay the Help to Buy scheme. If I were the National Party, I'd actually be a little bit concerned that the Greens might be coming after their spot as the junior coalition partner in this coalition of the willing, because we know that the Greens have got more senators than the National Party. So on the numbers, the Nationals might have the right to be the Deputy Prime Minister. If the we've seen Conservatives in other countries around the world have a three-way partnership around power sharing, why wouldn't Mr Dutton do that? I mean, who would go first as Deputy Prime Minister? Would it be Mr Bant?
Thank you, Minister. Minister Wong. Minister Watt, I've called you about three times.
So further questions be placed on notice.